Northwest Arkansas Art Museum celebrates a massive expansion project. An Arkansas state trooper faces decertification for allegedly planting drugs during a traffic stop, and a test of strength, forearm strength specifically, comes to Little Rock. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. I'm Daniel Breen, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the natural state. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Breen with Little Rock Public Radio. A Southeast Arkansas woman is suing the Arkansas State Police and a former state trooper over a 2023 traffic stop that ended in a drug arrest. Little Rock Public Radio's Josie Lenora has more as the trooper in question heads to a decertification hearing.
In October of 2024, the Arkansas State Police got a civilian complaint. A woman named Amanda Prince had been arrested about a year earlier. She said the trooper who arrested her violated her civil rights and framed her for drug possession. The complaint sent State Police Lieutenant Marcus Daniels into an investigation of his own department. We can't play some of the words he uses to describe his fellow officer's work, but he does say there's room for improvement.
You play on people's lives, man. Yeah. You see all the time people be, wrongly accused of stuff, man. Don't be that guy.
That's him grilling former state trooper Christian Walker Morphis, who arrested Amanda Prince back in 2023. For 80 minutes, Lieutenant Daniels peppers Morphis with questions and comments that all kind of sound like, you sure about that?
Once you tell a lie, you have to tell several little lies to keep that lie going.
Yes, sir.
Prince was within a mile of her Lake Village home when Morphis pulled her over, so close to her house she could see it in the distance. Prince was driving on a suspended license. This part she doesn't dispute. Here's what Morphis sounded like when he pulled her over.
If you're coming from the ER or whatever, we could possibly talk about it. But just because you want to go to the freaking grocery store, that's not an excuse.
Within a few minutes, Amanda Prince was handcuffed in the back seat of the trooper's car. He never did a pat down. He didn't even check her for drugs. When they arrived at the police station, Morphis told Prince that he found illegal drugs in the back of his car. 16 grams of cocaine in a small bag on the car floorboard. It had to be her bag of drugs, Morphis insisted, because he said he, quote, just left the car wash.
When I vacuumed out my back seat, that bag of dope was not there. I didn't see that bag of dope. So, and I knew that she was the only person in my back seat after vacuuming it out.
Handcuffed, standing in front of the trooper, about to book her in the county jail, Prince was angry.
Oh, crap, because that was not on me.
Well, that's fine. I got a camera that watched the whole thing.
Something didn't add up. Prince told Little Rock Public Radio she knew the cocaine Morphis was holding out in front of him wasn't hers. In a split-second event seen in the surveillance video from the backseat of Morphis's car, backs her story up. About 17 minutes in, a hand opens the front door of the car and throws in something that appears to be a small bag filled with white powder. At this point, Prince is already in the backseat of the police car, enclosed in a metal cage, hands cuffed behind her back. Prince didn't know about the video when she was booked on possession of drugs. She spent the next 4 days in jail. She was released on bond 30 minutes before the end of her 46th birthday. Possession of cocaine carries up to 20 years under Arkansas law. And on top of that, Morphis charged her with intent to distribute. Prince was facing decades in prison. In her complaint, she said she was publicly humiliated by the whole ordeal, losing her job, her apartment, and her dad's truck while she waited for trial. Waiting for trial felt terrifying.
Constant fear, constant sorrow, really.
In the lead up to her trial, Prince wondered whether jurors would believe her over a state trooper. She says a public defender told her, you need to have your personal effects in order. After trial, you're going straight back into custody. While jurors deliberated, Prince went to smoke a cigarette, thinking it may be her last minutes of freedom. Somewhere, she had heard that shorter deliberations mean guilty verdicts. So when jurors deliberated for only about 15 minutes, she was worried. But Prince was acquitted of all charges.
2 tons of relief. Yeah. Definitely. I can't say that I'm 100% relieved even to this day. I mean, it's something that still affects me day by day.
The sleight of hand at the 17-minute mark of the backseat video didn't come up at trial. But on the stand, Morphis struggled to explain his decision-making in the arrest. Investigating the case, Lieutenant Daniels hounded Morphis on one issue. Did you watch the internal police car video before charging Prince with drug possession? In his initial report, Morphis said he did watch it back. The report said Prince, quote, appeared to be moving very erratically for a short period of time and appeared to be digging in her waistline. But in the interrogation, he says,
I don't remember. I don't want to tell you one thing and not be truthful. I don't remember, honestly.
The video doesn't match the description Morphis wrote in the report. Prince was handcuffed in a narrow cage that only covered half the back seat. She was stone still and never dug in her pockets. Prince told Little Rock Public Radio this was intentional.
He initially put me in the back of the car. I was like, self, keep your movement to a minimum because they record in the car. So I knew not to be moving around a lot and stuff, so I did not.
Midway through the interrogation, Lieutenant Daniels calls Morphis out.
I'm just going to tell you, Morphis, that's a lie. She never dug in her waistline. She, the erratic moving, her turning her head, is the most moving that she did. And Morphis, you lost to a public defender.
Right.
So you know that the case wasn't strong.
Right.
Then Morphis changes his story.
But I feel confident in saying that at some point before I wrote those tickets, I went back and I watched her in my backseat.
Lieutenant Daniels investigated how Prince was arrested. He even simulated the incident with a police employee the same size as Prince and wearing a similar outfit.
The complainant in this case was handcuffed behind her back with the palms facing outward. Miss Ashley is handcuffed in the same fashion.
The police employee couldn't pull a bag of drugs out of her pocket the way Morphis describes.
You know, but you're not 100% that the dope is hers.
No, sir, I wasn't.
But the way you articulated in your report, you're saying things that she didn't do, man.
Morphis doesn't defend the stop as a banner moment in his career. He told Daniels he was having a hard time in his personal life. He was, quote, mad he was at work.
I had an attitude problem. I'm aware of that. I'm working on it. I can't tell you it's 100% fixed, but I can tell you that we're miles from where we started.
For him, this whole thing was embarrassing.
If we take away this uniform and all the honor that it brings, and just me as a man, that's not the person I want to be.
Morphis wasn't fired for possibly planting drugs. The termination letter says Morphis was fired for not doing his job, not giving Prince a pat down, and not filling out the report correctly. Things that could have cleared the situation up and saved Amanda Prince a lot of trouble.
He was fine with sending me off for 20 years. And that's scary because that could be anybody's sister, anybody's mother, anybody's aunt, anybody's wife.
The state police report still doesn't address some of the biggest questions from the case, like where the cocaine came from, why Morphis didn't follow proper procedure. A spokesperson for the Arkansas State Police said they have no comment on ongoing litigation. The Commission on Law Enforcement Standards and Training set a hearing to consider his decertification for June 10th. Meanwhile, Prince has filed suit in federal court against the Arkansas State Police, seeking $1 million. Prince and her lawyer told Little Rock Public Radio they would be willing to accept a settlement. She wants to get back to her life. At the time of this airing, the agency has filed no response.
That was Little Rock Public Radio's Josie Lenora reporting. An expansion at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville will open to the public this weekend. KUAF's Jack Travis was part of a preview tour of the new 114,000-square-foot expansion and brings us this report.
Since opening on November 11, 2011, Crystal Bridges has dominated Northwest Arkansas's art landscape. What began as a way for Walmart heiress Alice Walton to share her private art collection with her home state grew into a 200,000-square-foot world-class art museum. And soon, you'll be able to see the museum's next chapter, a more than 50% increase in gallery space, and a reimagining of how the public will engage with the art. Before folks can stand in a space, it has to be built, and before that, envisioned. Moshe Softy, the architect who dreamed up the facility and all its light, water, and greenery, visited last week and shared the origin of his collaboration.
As we go back now 20 years, when I got the call from Bentonville, will you come and meet Alice Walton? And she wants to talk to you about possibilities of building a new museum. Because at the end of the day, I said, Alice, how are you going to pick an architect? You're going to do a competition.
For Walton, there was no need for a competition.
And she said, no, I've chosen him tonight, and that was it. So This whole thing began with a spirit of extraordinary trust.
Before work ever started on the update, Walton requested Softy draw up a master plan for the future of the museum, so other architects wouldn't spoil his vision. Instead, they decided to get the work done while Softy was still able to see it through himself.
We wanted, I thought it would be appropriate to diversify the experience. I think what's happened here is that it was a building. Crystal Bridges was like a cluster of buildings. It's now become a little village. It's more than a building, and I think that is a quantum jump in terms of the visitor's experience.
The first part of that new little village was the Learning and Engagement Hub. Chief Learning and Engagement Officer Marissa Reyes gave an overview of what this place can be for visitors. She says it's not only somewhere to learn, but also unwind. The Community Lounge offers that respite, while the Learning Engagement Hub stimulates creativity.
When you come to the hub, we believe that everyone is an artist. There's an artist in all of us and all of you. And the materials, the art making, the artists that you'll encounter in the hub is really an opportunity for you to feel that creativity and artistry within you.
People can attend classes or spontaneously pop in and create something, be it a pencil drawing or throwing a clay pot. Next to the hub was a corridor that seems a bit empty. Take a closer look, and you'll find it's filled with art. Not only has museum staff introduced and reinstalled works into new galleries, Austin Baron Bailey, Deputy Director for Curatorial Affairs, says they've moved into unconventional spaces as well.
So be on the lookout for how we have brought the strategies of art activated on our campus outdoors. The integration of art, architecture, and nature we've tried to intensify through the placement of art in unexpected places and throughout the experience. We really want to soften the kind of reverent edges of the art gallery, make it more comfortable, and make it so that art is everywhere and part of your everyday.
From here, you can take the elevators or the stairs up to the temporary gallery space, which is currently housing Keith Haring in 3D. The gallery is an open space with thoughtful, diffused lighting, creating a cathedral-like experience. A fitting tone for the gallery that, at this moment, holds Keith Haring's final piece, a triptych funeral altar that he made before he died of AIDS-related complications in 1990. Travel back down the stairs or elevator, and you'll come to a gallery that encapsulates Crystal Bridges in both name and spirit. The glass bridge is just that, a glass structure spanning the length between the Learning Hub and the new Contemporary Art Gallery. Glass is an element of the structure and the art within. Wingate Curator of Craft Jen Paget says that the glass bridge perfectly pairs with how the museum staff has grown the collection.
In the past 5 years, we've really been focused on adding works to the collection in that area of craft. So thinking about skilled making and materials like ceramics, glass, wood, fiber, and metal. Of this gallery space and the adjacent reflection space, there's 43 works on view, and 39 of those works are new to the Crystal Bridges collection. So when people come into this space, they're going to be seeing a lot of work for the first time in this new space, which is really exciting. One of the things that has been in the collection but is also being foregrounded in a new way is talking also about gems and minerals.
It's a nice place to mention it. She stands in the middle of the glass bridge, between the museum's new cafe, Quartz and Honey, and a large Arkansas quartz crystal the museum has frequently displayed. She says they took advantage of a unique opportunity. Bringing bright materials into a quiet space allows for reflection. The new spaces actually surround an outdoor courtyard set atop a pond, almost giving it the appearance of a floating platform. And on said platform, there will be a community gathering space, complete with a splash pad for kids. New trails are also being installed around Crystal Bridges' 134-acre campus as part of the expansion, with new sculptures and plantings alongside them. Finally, across the bridge, folks will find themselves in the new Contemporary Art Gallery, featuring new and familiar works, like Infinity Mirrored Room by Yayoi Kusama. Crystal Bridges will host an opening celebration on June 6th and 7th. You can visit our website for photos of the expansion and more information about the public celebration.
That was KUAF's Jack Travis reporting. Arm wrestlers and fans from around the world are descending on Central Arkansas this weekend. I spoke with Arkansas native Monster Michael Todd, one of the sport's most successful athletes, and Robert Baxter, CEO of East vs. West Arm Wrestling, ahead of the group's tournament this weekend in Little Rock.
Michael's the main guy here, but I've been in it for actually not even as long as Michael. I got in kind of late, 30 years old, and started arm wrestling, you know, got 7 world championships, and just love arm wrestling, and it's just been a passion of mine. And now to be able to do East versus West, and we've got our best arm wrestlers, the very top in all the world, combined for the first time in one league. It's never been done before. It's always been different leagues, different parts of the world. It's kind of kept everybody separated, and that's one of the reasons why I think arm wrestling has taken off so much, and it's becoming quite a mainstream sport. Just got back from an event in Germany, in Cologne, Germany, where we broke all the records for attendance. It's really starting to get momentum now. And so looking forward to Little Rock. This is going to be, you know, the biggest event we've had in the United States. 12 different countries coming to Arkansas, you know, representing the best guys around the world and gals around the world. And Michael Todd is the key. He's the one that's been pushing to make this happen. And he's made it happen because he's actually pulling for the lightweight world.
Light heavyweight. I'm not that small. I did cut down from over 300 pounds in December all the way down to 231.5 pounds for light heavyweight world title. It was supposed to be for the heavyweight world title, but unfortunately the champ lost to Rush and we couldn't get him a visa. I said, since it's in Arkansas, it's in my home state, I'll go ahead and cut the other 22 pounds and go for that light heavyweight world title. So I've been in this thing since 1990. I'm a redneck from Arkansas. I could beat everybody in high school. I was in Botec my senior year. They looked across the table and said, that guy over there is second in the state. I got on a cafeteria table, beat him, said, you should go to this tournament. That was a 1990 Saline County Fair. Fast forward 36 years, 23 world titles, 36 national titles, traveled all over the world. And now I'm vying for my 24th world title this weekend. Arkansas has always been my home. So yeah, I live in Hot Springs now. My wife and I live in Hot Springs. She's a 7-time national champion. My stepson's a 7-time national champion. So I guess we're all pretty good at it.
Arm wrestling, I think we all know what that is. I think we've all done it. But what was the first time y'all were exposed to the fact that, hey, maybe this could be more than just, you know, an amateur pastime? This could be a professional thing.
Well, I saw it back in the day. I mean, I don't know if you remember Wide World of Sports, Petaluma. They had the, you know, televised, and then it went to Sylvester Stallone, had a movie Over the Top in 1987. It was actually a pretty big hit, box office hit. And then, you know, I heard about that. I watched that kind of stuff. Didn't know that it was something that you could really get into. I didn't know about tournaments. Didn't know about leagues. Just watched it on TV or in the movie, and then got into it that way.
As far as how I got started, like I said, Saline County Fair. I'd watched Over the Top, but then I just progressed through the ranks. Won my first nationals in 2000. First world title 2005. And from there, it was basically just getting invites to different leagues, different organizations. I've actually won the heavyweight world, super heavyweight world title for every major professional promotion except for East versus West. And that's what we're going to talk about. East versus West 24, Little Rock, Arkansas, this Saturday. The event starts at noon. Doors open at 10:30, bringing the biggest, baddest arm wrestling event in North America to Arkansas. This man has already told me if this is a success, if Arkansas shows up to support, they will bring it back to Little Rock every single year. So we need Arkansas to show up. Bring your family, bring your kids. It's family friendly. If you've ever seen an arm wrestling event before and you think that's what you come to see, that's like going to a parking lot wrestling promotion and then ended up going to WWE. What you're going to see is the highest level of sports entertainment. The production values is equivalent to UFC. You will come watch this and you'll be a fan for life.
This specific event, East versus West, is it sort of like a bracket type thing, a tournament? How does an individual match work? And then how does the larger event work?
That's a great question. Okay, so professional arm wrestling is just like fighting. It's one-on-one. We regular matches are best 3 out of 5. World titles or co-main events are 4 out of 7. So Saturday is a professional card. It's just like going and renting a UFC card. You're going to have 15 fights on the card, 15 matches. But the cool thing about that first match that comes on the card, we're going to pick 2 people from the Friday night tournament. So show up here, come, go ahead and register. It's an open tournament from your first time arm wrestler to your world champion. So everybody that's listening has a friend that's never been beat. Tell them to come out and show us what they got.
On the eve of this big event, what is your sort of routine leading up to it? How do you prepare for something like this?
Well, I'm starving right now because I got to make weight tomorrow. So normally I'm a super heavyweight. Like I said, I was over 300 pounds in December competing in the heavyweight division. My last match was in the super heavyweight division, and I was probably 288 then, and that was in February. So I'm down 50 pounds since February for this opportunity. When you get a chance to pull for the world title, especially one that you've never won before, you're going to do whatever it takes to get there. So normally right now it's merch signing, it's press, it's, you know, photos, VIPs, meeting the athletes. I mean, this man's running around like crazy. This is a lot on his shoulders right now. And I helped set this up, but right now I'm like, guys, I'm handing this over to y'all. I'm out. I'm an athlete. I'm focused on my match. But this particular instance, it's basically get till 8 o'clock in the morning, stand on the scales, make weight, and then rehydrate, get some IV fluids, and enjoy the day.
As you all have been mentioning, the popularity of the sport is rising. Kind of a two-part question. One, why do you think the popularity is rising? But also, do y'all notice any sort of trends? Is there like a specific region or a specific country that it's becoming especially popular in?
It's going very big in North America. It's just taken off. It's been big in Europe for quite a while. We just opened up China, first time ever. We didn't even know, but we flew into China 6 months ago. And they already knew all about East versus West. They already knew about Michael Todd. They have clubs, arm wrestling clubs, all throughout China with hundreds of people. There's several with 1,000 people more in one arm wrestling club that actually train together. And I mean, they're just math. Like, we have nothing like that in North America or even Europe, nothing that big. So we're opening up markets all over the world. Our next event is in Batumi, Georgia, Republic of Georgia, which is a massive market. It's probably the most fans per capita and the most world champions per capita in that little country of Georgia. And so that's already, you know, hit completely the top of the scale for popularity. And a lot of countries in Eastern Europe and in Europe have just taken off. Japan is also very big in arm wrestling. And now it's time for North America, and it is blowing up.
COVID blew arm wrestling up. There was no professional sports. There was no live sports for people to watch. They went on YouTube. They found me. They found Devin Laird. They found a few of. There's a half a dozen people that they went and found that have become relatively semi-famous from it. Just my brand alone, Monster Michael Todd, has had over 400 million views since 2022 just off my social platforms. Now, if you talk about all the videos that I'm on with other channels and everything, it's in the billions, right? But that's because of people found arm wrestling during COVID and they became fans. What it was is we have all the characters. It's just the masses hadn't met us yet. Once the fans found us, they found out, you know, you either love me or you hate me, you know. And then Devin Leonard's the most beloved arm wrestler in the world. Doesn't matter what he does. He can do nothing wrong. So you just find someone, you gravitate towards them, and that's who you're going to be a fan of. And people will tune in to watch me win. People will tune in to watch me lose. Either way, they're going to tune in.
That was Monster Michael Todd and Robert Baxter speaking about this weekend's East versus West 24 professional arm wrestling tournament in Little Rock. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode on any of our station's websites. Until next time, I'm Daniel Breen, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.